B2, number 16B.
Yes. You know what I want to show you is something which I have written in two books, in two thick books. Books which have been bought and read and not in the slightest understood. Except perhaps just five or six. I don't think more. Anyway, I only know about three who did it. Terrific. And if you give your whole life and time and energy and thinking and pondering and to something which you see absolutely new and big, and you tell it to the audience and they don't see it, what is it? See, it has to do with the Bible. And it has to do with the textbook. Those two big textbooks. Let's take the Bible as an illustration. The Bible has for a long time been read as a Bible, a historical record. What has happened in times past, in the Old Testament, in the New Testament. Then came John Dorley along and took the whole biblical symbol out of the time concept or of the language of the Bible, and with the help of the key to the scripture lifted it out of the biblical language into metaphysical language, like showing "Let there be light." He said, "This is not light. This is let there be intelligence." Therefore, began to interpret according to Mrs. Eddy's use of the biblical terms, began to interpret more and more the biblical symbols in today's metaphysical ideas. That the river is a flow of thought. That the firmament is understanding, according to Mrs. Eddy. And through finding this key to the symbols of the Bible, he was able to present the whole Bible story in a new language, in a metaphysical language, and no more in that nice symbolic language of yesterday. Therefore, he went, as you know, through the whole Old Testament and most of the New Testament, gave those wonderful talks on the Bible, taking practically each book of the Bible and going over nearly verse by verse, interpreting everything into the language of metaphysics. This has naturally an enormous advantage, namely, first of all, that we can now read the Bible in our day's language, no more in the language of the past. Second, it had that great advantage that it gave us the feeling the Bible has nothing to do with the past, but with the present. That if we could translate the symbolism, say, of Noah and his ark and the flood and Mount Ararat and everything out of the biblical symbol into metaphysical symbol, seeing that it had to do with separating in consciousness between the material and the spiritual, building an ark and pitching it, therefore building a spiritual consciousness and pitching it so that we never let any other concept come in. That's the pitching of the ark, has suddenly become that wonderful practical sense within us that we must have a consciousness, an ark, which is absolutely pitched so that no mortal thought, no human thought, no erroneous thought can come in. It has shown how wonderful that is if we do that, that the whole world can reign and reign and reign with all sorts of false thoughts and so on, and that the floods of mortal mind can come, and the only thing that happens is that it lifts it up. We never get drowned. It only lifts it up. gives that wonderful symbol that in that ark there was a window on the top, but not on the side, not on the bottom, but on the top, that our consciousness in such a situation must always be above, to the highest, look out to the highest, not look at the evil, what's going on, and that if we do that, then comes after a while a stage where we rest on Mount Ararat, where we find again our ground under our feet, and then we land somewhere much higher than where we started the experience. See, in this way, just quickly shown, you see, he began to show by translating biblical symbols out of a time concept and out of a biblical language into a metaphysical language. That is the purpose of the glossary, that he says it is translating the biblical term into metaphysical term, which is also their spiritual sense and no more the material sense. The whole Bible was lifted out of that historical sense, out of that material sense, into a present spiritual sense of things. And that was his great work, to which he was very much devoted. To the last day, he wrote the last report, verbatim report on the last book on the Old Testament, Malachi, just 3 days before he passed on. So, completed more or less the Old Testament, and therefore left us a wonderful idea, namely that the Bible should not be read as it is read, as a historical record, but as a metaphysical presentation of ever-present ideas, that Noah is not the figure in the past, that I am Noah, that Abraham is not the figure in the past, that I am Abraham. I have also to go out from the land of Ur, out of necromancy and delusion, and have to wander and wander and wander until I find the new land, the promised land. Each one has to do that. Each one is that Abraham. He showed that each one is a Jacob, each one is a Joseph, each one is a Moses. Each one has to cross the Red Sea, each one has to cross Jordan, each one has to settle down, each one has to ask himself the question, shall I have a king or shall I not have a king, and so on, and so on, and so on. You can see that he gave to that Bible, which for 2,000 years were misunderstood, a living, practical, ever-present sense. By just translating the biblical symbols into metaphysical symbols. And he left us at that point. Now, when he left us, we were naturally most impressed with that aspect of his teaching, which was only one aspect, because side by side to it, he gave those very fundamental systematic teaching about the seven and the four and so on. And so we devoted quite a bit of time to digest this, and then came the next step, namely the step which said, isn't there an overall pattern in the whole Bible? Because as far as Mr. Dorling went, he always only showed the structure of each book of the Bible. And so Gordon Brown was one of the most one who was most interested in this idea, and therefore began to look at that whole presentation which Mr. Dawley gave into a more structural sense, and so he began to see that all these books linked together in a wonderful structure. So he wrote that book from Genesis to Revelation, in which he put together those isolated books which Mr. Dawley had interpreted, put them together into a great big structure. Now, that's how far as our things went. And now comes the point. I told you this morning that when I went to London and gave those talks on the textbook that I could only go first up to the chapter on animal magnetism. And then something just said to me, stop. And that chapter on animal magnetism has given me somehow a clue and said to me, go and get first a warm, round, tony sense. You know what the tony sense is? Sense of tones and not of words, of the Christ. And as I could see there, the great coincidence between the chapter on animal magnetism with the Joel, Book of Joel, I began to study those prophets. They are, the minor prophets are very easy to overlook because they only contain a few books, and I think that was the great advantage. And I began to do the same thing, so to say, what Mr. Dawley did, by trying to put the language of the prophets into the language of metaphysics, because John Dawley only did two or three of the minor prophets. He didn't do all of them. So I was interested in the other ones and thought I would like to put that into the same way as John Dawley, and did it. And I found in each one of these minor prophets a structure, a wonderful structure, as I said, the one in the word order, others in the four orders, and so on. And when I did that, I asked myself, why are there 16? And so it came to the matrix form, which we did yesterday, which showed that these 16 prophets are not one, are 16... prophets building together a whole structure, a matrix, a Christ matrix. Well, fine. When I began to see that Christ matrix, which wasn't really a great step forward, because as I said, Gordon Brown has done the same with the whole Bible before, not in detail as I did it, then suddenly one day something talked to me and said, what's the use of translating a biblical language into metaphysical language? And I could see that it has very small use. And just that it makes the Bible better understood, because the language of metaphysics for us is easier to be understood. It makes that language present. I could see, oh, I am a Hosea, I am a Joel, I am an Amos, I am an Obadiah, I am a Jonah. That I could see too, but that was John Dawley had shown long ago with Noah and Abraham and so on. But then I said to myself, how can I be a Hosea or a Joel? Just only by being the metaphysical interpretation of those. To me that was limited. I suddenly began to see that something must have been at work, the infinite, let's say, at work, which dictated to those prophets those prophecies. But I could see that those prophecies were adapted to a situation, to a specific situation. And therefore I said to myself, but that which dictates a specific situation is nothing else but the translation of the divine mind to the point of idea. And what the prophets were showing were these specific ideas in a certain specific case. But mind is 100 times bigger than a specific case. And therefore I could see that we should lift this presentation out of its metaphysical meaning further back into the meaning of the synonymous term, into the scientific meaning. We come back to that later on, the difference between metaphysics and science. And that only in this way I would find a much greater law a much greater fact behind each of these prophets than just what the prophets were telling me. A much bigger. I show you this because I think I can draw it to you. I draw you something which has nothing to do with any prophet. I draw you something, actually Bill should draw it, he's the artist. Here is a nice tree, a wonderful tree, you know, but somehow a tree comes.
Yeah.
And from here, falls an apple away from the tree. And it falls right down then. That's what Newton saw. And Newton saw an apple falling. Everybody had seen an apple falling before. He saw the same phenomena, but it meant something else for him. For him it meant that there is a law behind it, and not just a phenomenon. It meant the law behind it. So, that law was the law of gravitation, as you know, and so he could take that phenomena and translate it in many other phenomena. Say, they could go to Pisa, something like that, huh? At the Tower of Pisa. Is that any good, Bill? Tower of Pisa, and go on the top here and let the stone fall. That's the normal stone fall. You see, that's man-made. That's happened in nature. That's experiment. That's natural law. That's taking a natural law and put it into experiments. Namely, you can repeat this natural law how many times you like. But every time, it is the law of gravitation. Or, you can take another one. You can take, say, the Earth. And here the Moon. And you know when that the water, when the Moon is up here, goes a bit further up, and that's the flood. What do you call flood or tide?
Tide.
And on the other side it goes inward, huh? Because there is here an unseen gravitation. Three completely different pictures. Three completely different phenomena. Behind it is the same law. The law of gravitation. Can you see that? Now, let's take... This is the story of a minor prophet. Shown in its natural way, in historical way, how the Lord comes and has to deal with Nineveh and so on, and how the armies of Assyria come and so on, and hell and high water and so on. That's what happened in nature and history, taken as a symbol. What Mr. Dolly did, he said, I can translate that to a metaphysical representation. I don't need to have the same symbols. I can put it into a symbol which is perhaps more exact, more abstract, which is in the language of today. He translated it into a more understandable image or presentation of the very same thing. That's what Mrs. Eddy has done with the biblical terms and put it into metaphysical terms. And so, also here, that's another representation, completely different. You wouldn't recognize each to the other. One wouldn't say, what has that to do with this if one wouldn't know anything about the law of gravitation? We would say, they have nothing in common. And yet they are the same thing. Can you see that? So, we can do that ad libit to take any prophet and just interpret it in our day's language. Now comes the crux of the thing. But what did Newton do? Newton said, actually, I'm not interested in this phenomena, I'm not interested in this phenomena, I'm not interested in this phenomena, I'm only interested in the law. And so he took all those phenomena together and said, I'll show you what it is. Is there a physician here, a physicist here? What is the abbreviation for power, F or P, force or power, in physics? Nobody, doesn't matter. Let's say it's power, the abbreviation. He said, well, power is that this is it. That's the law of gravitation. That this here is this law. This here is this law. This here is this law. It means that the power of gravitation, I don't know if you say P or F or force, this power of gravitation is nothing else than the gravitation constant multiplied by the mass 1, this one, with the mass 2, the Earth, divided by the distance from these two masses in the square. This is the law of gravitation. With this, you can calculate how the rockets go off from the Earth, how they go around the moon and come back. All the law of gravitation, because this works. It's a question that the power at work in gravitation to get the rocket out of the gravitational field of the Earth is defined by the mass of the moon multiplied by the mass of the Earth divided by the distance from these two masses in the square. That's the formula. Can you see what science does? Science does not take one phenomena and tries to symbolize with another phenomena, and then with another phenomena. It goes and says, no, I reduce phenomena to nomina, to the law. And so, really, this formula of the law of gravitation is the thing that matters. But now comes the point. If I have this law, Christoph, then I have infinite applications of this law. Because I can change this MI and the M2, mass 1, mass 2. Here it is an apple and the Earth. Here is a stone and the Earth. Here is the moon and the Earth. I can change this ad libitum. I can change the distance between them. And so this law is applicable for any experiment, for any phenomena of gravitation. That's clear. How, through putting a phenomena back to its nomenon, to its source, to its principle, we find a principle which then is not only applicable just to this one phenomenon, but which is applicable to infinite possibilities. Now we come back to the prophets, for instance, to the Bible. What we have done at first is to have taken here a prophet, say this is Nahum, and have interpreted in a metaphysical language so that we can understand it like this. And they have written about Nahum in a metaphysical language which uses different terms and have been satisfied with this second expression. It is a bit for a step forward, because here with this phenomena you can make more definite experiments, you can measure it properly, this apple, you never know which apple falls and how heavy it is and so on. I have to watch all autumn until it falls down. You see, here you can go and say, I'm going to determine when it goes to fall down, I know the distance of it, I know the weight of this stone and so on. See, you get to a more clear cut, the more concrete, more exact demonstration and of this same phenomenon. That's what we have been doing. And at that point, you see, I thought, this is not big enough for us. Because why should this law, which came from God, from the synonym, why should this Nahum say, who prophesied from the source of a synonym, and show a idea of each synonym, why shouldn't that be enlarged to the synonym itself? So that the same law is applicable in any situation. Yes. I want to try to show it to you, say, on the example of any of the minor prophets. Let's take a simple one like Nahum. Here's a very simple one. I mean, there's only two or three pages. In that chart, which we have been considering, Nahum appeared there where in the Christianity as the word. Christianity, there was the restoration of the idea. Restoration of the idea, and in the word, the defined. The word defines it. What is the restoration of the idea? Now, I go now and show you the same process that I have shown you with the law of gravitation. I show it to you now with Nahum. It's the symbol of Nahum. Nahum is built up in a sevenfold way, to seven stages. Mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. He begins his story, and it's all, sorry, I should say that first. His whole story, because it is Christianity as the word, is showing that the belief reigns, that error can be tenacious, so that the idea cannot be restored. Or, in simple words, what you have very often, that you say, here I have a problem, which is so tenacious, that God can't do a thing to it. See, that's the problem of Nahum. And he shows it through his language and adapted to a situation of his time. How does it show the tenacity of error? The sevenfold tenacity of error. He begins his story, I don't know the exact word, but I give you just a nice children's story about Nahum. You see, he begins his story and says, there is that big power, Nineveh. And that Nineveh, you know, those bad boys, they just do anything they like and get away with it. They are unlawful. He depicts them as very unlawful and says, and I see that they always get away with it. And then Nahum comes and says, no, they can't get away with it. The Lord will come down and he will not allow it. He comes down as really the big law of or power.